So welcome to the Intern Whisper. My name is Isabella Johnston, and as all of my listeners know, we always have a thought leader on my show every week. I want to welcome you to our show. It's all about the future of work and innovation. And today's guest is Michelle Natalia, hopefully I said it right, Moore, founder of MindEquity.org, and she helps experienced professionals focus better and sustain high performance with well-being. She started her career in business with MTV Europe in Munich. That's amazing. I can't wait to hear about it. And Space Commerce Corporation in Houston, followed by 15 years with PricewaterhouseCoopers and Ernst & Young, launching and building various tech consulting practices in Moscow. Now, what she does now, we move fast to 2010. That's not now, but in 2010, she moved to Toronto and is pivoting to the tech for good and nonprofit sector at that time. In 2019, she created Mind Equity, a social purpose consultancy to help tech and consulting teams improve performance without burnout. And since 2023, she splits her time between Orlando and Toronto, totally two different types of weather climates. I can't wait to hear it. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Isabella. Glad to be here.
So we always kick the show off for our listeners where I ask, what are five words that describe you and why those five words? And you so graciously sent them to me. So let me kick you off with the word collaborative. Why collaborative?
So I know this is a common one, but I had to keep it in my list because collaboration is what energizes me. I'm not a person who likes to work alone. And I find that what one creates in concert with other human beings is just much more amazing than trying to do something on your own. And so I thrive in a collaborative environment.
That's a really good definition. I'm going to borrow that one for myself next time. How about cross-cultural empath? That's a phrase. I like this one. And it's all alliteration.
So this is very specific to my upbringing. I was raised in a multicultural family. So my mother is German. My dad is American. I have an adopted Iranian sister. I grew up in two countries. I grew up in Germany and in the US, in Ohio and in Texas. You could argue two different countries there by themselves as states. But I just learned this love of the other cultures and other worlds growing up in that bicultural, bilingual environment, and also having a sister of a different color also had a big impact on how I was raised in terms of paying attention to how a person of a minority experiences the world in a different way, and being side by side and advocating also for, you know, sometimes unforeseen, uncomfortable circumstances was a given fact in my upbringing. I decided to study abroad. I studied abroad both in Munich and then moved on to have my first job after MBA in Russia and spent 15 years in Russia. So I also married a Russian. My first husband is Russian. And my cross-cultural stuff continues. I divorced in Moscow, but then after an intervention of my American girlfriends in Moscow and being single for 6 years, I met an Indian Canadian from Toronto online, and that's why I moved to Canada. And then my daughter is, she says she is a Russian-American-Armenian Canadian, and she identifies with all four of those cultures.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that's why I say I'm a cross-cultural empath. And my circle of friends tends to be very multicultural as well. And that's a
Enough
weird word.
Said. But, yeah, I love but, it. Yeah. That's a cool story too. Okay, so embodied. The third one was embodied. I've never had that one before. So this is a very interesting choice in my opinion.
So embodied is a new word for me. It's maybe only 10 years old that I've used it. And that's because when I moved to Canada, I began to do some more self-reflection after, you know, having, you know, switching a country again, leaving Moscow and that career after 15 years and being in what I would call a normal country, a safe country, a country that's very calm and nice. I had space to do some self-reflection. And I discovered really that I am very much in my head. I an analytic person, you know, anyone who does an MBA and does strategy consulting or SAP implementations and, you know, tech-driven change tends to be a bit heady. And so I began to explore, well, what is it like really to be in the body? So I did various trainings at the Presencing Institute on awareness-based systems change and learned, you know, that there's a brain in the gut as well as in the head, and that when we pay attention to how we're feeling and moving through the world as an embodied human, we are all embodied humans, that our experience in the workplace and in personal life and in nature is different. And so it opened up a world for me, and I even became a teacher in this embodied practice for innovation at the Presencing Institute. And that is something that I continue to struggle with. How can I balance being in my body as much as I am in my head and be a more holistic person that experiences my whole humanness in the world, so to speak, rather than just using the body as a transportation unit for the head, which is what I think I spent most of my life doing.
It's very futuristic the way that you described it. You know, we're all, and you know, I agree with you to a certain place also, because we're all just passing through this world, and this is just the vehicle that we're in, this particular body, until we exchange it for something else. So it makes sense to me. I come from a spiritual background, more not religious, spiritual. They're very different in my opinion too. So okay, fourth one, optimistic.
I definitely always see the glass half full. And I think I've just been that way since birth. And it helps me, yeah, it helps me navigate through what now, unfortunately, I think is a scarier and scarier world. And I have to just focus on the optimistic piece of every human and every situation. Otherwise, I think I would be bogged down and miserable. So it's just a choice.
It is a choice. It really, really is. Okay, tech adjacent, again, a two-part word to it. So tech adjacent.
So I call myself tech adjacent because I've never coded a thing. I don't have deep IT training or deep IT knowledge, but I have always worked with technology teams. I have always created and been able to articulate the business case for implementing a certain piece of tech. And that's what my career was based on. So after my MBA, which was in strategy, I, you know, moved to PwC, and they didn't really know what to do with me as a consultant, as a junior, you know, consultant in Moscow. And I already had the Russian language skills. So this was sort of why I was ideal. But I got chosen to go to Philadelphia, Moscow for 6-week SAP financial controlling module configuration training. So I was part of that very first wave. This dates me. First wave, SAP was just coming out. And we created, I was part of that first SAP implementation team for major oil and gas clients in Moscow. I didn't really become a configurer. I soon became a project manager and then was doing, you know, the tech-driven change. And that led me to later on do IT audit or manage teams doing IT audit and IT security and IT governance around the Sarbanes-Oxley stuff. And then even in Canada, I was building tech teams doing philanthropy tech implementation, like grant-making software. And then I also worked with clients in collaborative tech. So always tech adjacent, but I am definitely not a techie. I'm more a humanist and the liberal arts, you know, person than I am a tech person. So that's why I call myself tech adjacent. But I love being tech adjacent. I can't not be in the tech world, right? But that imposter syndrome does come in sometimes because I don't code.
I don't think you have to be a person that codes to be in tech, because, you know, your iPhone is tech. You have to learn how to navigate all of the changes that are being implemented and everything that you do on your phone/computer. And in this world, I mean, you walk into a restaurant, you've got to be able to, there's no longer you go and talk to a person, say, hey, I want my sausage biscuit. You have to go order it at a kiosk, and it's tech. So I think you are a tech person. We all are, more than we realize it.
For sure, now we are, yeah.
Okay, so Michelle, tell us about where you went to school, how'd you get started in your career to where you are now? Take us along that path.
Okay, so I went to school in Houston, and I went then to the University of Texas for my undergraduate degree, where I did a major in Russian and in German literature. And at the time, I think there were only 8 Russian majors when I started as a freshman. And by the time I graduated, there were like 50. So it exploded. And I went to a career fair, actually. I had this idea that I wanted to be a spy, to be honest, which is why I studied Russian. And why did I want to be a spy? My mother escaped from East Germany before the wall was built. And there's a whole adventurous story about how the family split up and went on different trains. And as the Berlin Wall was being built, they still managed to cross over Bahnhof Friedrichstrasse and Checkpoint Charlie and make it safely to the West. And so when I was 16, we got to the German Wall. The Berlin Wall had not fallen yet. So East Germany and West Germany were still in place. And we got a day visa with my mom and my dad and my sister to visit a school friend of hers that she hadn't seen since she had escaped. And that whole experience had such an impact on me because it was, at 16, I perceived it just as pure adventure. And I wanted to understand what is beyond the Iron Curtain and who is spying and what is happening and all this intrigue, right? And so after that experience, I think this is why I decided, oh, I'm going to study Russian and I'm going to be a spy. Well, I'll tell you, I went to a career fair in my freshman year at the University of Texas in Austin. This career fair was run by the CIA and the US Information Agency. This is, I think, one time when I did listen to my gut. I met with those people because, and especially I was a Russian major, so I was of interest, you know, Russian and Arabic speaking people were of interest. It creeped me out so much. And my gut was just telling me there's no way you can ever join either of these organizations. And so my idea becoming a spy literally ended in freshman year, but I continued and finished my degree and didn't know what on earth am I going to do with this later. Then I decided, so cool. Well, it's bizarre, right? It's just a little, you know, about that childhood fantasy and, you know, how sort of things intrigue you and you don't really know why. And then you find out, well, that's a dead end. But after a liberal arts degree, I realized I'm going to have to either do a master's in law or in business. And I remember getting counsel from my father on this topic. He said, Michelle, don't do law because you'll get stuck in a particular jurisdiction. But if you do business, the world will remain open to you. So this was really good advice. And I did an MBA. And yes, it led me abroad and all that and gave me the flexibility I have always wanted. So after that, I moved. So in MBA school, at the University of Houston, in the MBA program, I actually met my first husband, who was on a Muskie fellowship to Houston from Turkmenistan. So Turkmenistan is a former Soviet republic. It produces cotton and oil. It's a Muslim republic, but it has a lot of Russians. So it turned out my ex-husband was a Russian Armenian from Turkmenistan, a very Soviet person, very smart, and ended up falling in love in the MBA program. And because I'd always wanted to work overseas, I said, I don't mind moving to Russia. And I moved to Russia without a job. We both did after our MBAs. And I got picked up right away by Price Waterhouse at the time. And as I already mentioned, started in that SAP practice and privatization was just happening. The US aid program was funding the Big Four at the time. This is January of 1995. And so all of the international companies were coming in, starting their practices, starting with audit. And of course, we were consulting. And it was a wild ride, I tell you. It was one of the most interesting times in my life. And the adventure and sort of traveling to Siberia for projects and being in these unknown environments, I just found it fascinating and energizing. And so I ended up staying in Russia for 15 years. And except for the 1 year that I flew back to Houston in month 8 of pregnancy to give birth to my child, my daughter in Houston. And I managed to land a job at Amoco Oil Company, while I was pregnant in month seven, I think they hired me, and I ended up staying in Houston for a year to nurture my child up to, you know, an age, age one before we went back to Moscow. And so then I returned to PricewaterhouseCoopers. And at some point along the way, I got recruited to the other side, to Ernst & Young. And so I switched firms and continued my career at Ernst & Young I started at PwC. After pregnancy, I went to Ernst & Young. Then I got recruited back to PwC and stayed at PwC until I left Moscow. And I moved to PwC in Canada in 2010 for a brief time.
That is so amazing. I don't know too many people who can make accounting sound dangerous and thrilling and almost like it was a spy story. So that is so cool.
Well, keep in mind, no accounting. I was in consulting, and consulting, I have to say, is a different ballgame than
that
accounting.
That is.
And not boring.
But they are accounting firms, aren't they?
The core business always started as accounting, but you can argue that consulting got bigger than accounting. Yeah. Yeah.
No, so. I agree with you. But, you know, they're known for their accounting history for sure. So interesting, Michelle. So with your totally unrelated question, but I'm just curious, with your child being in the United States for a year, do you think that she has American English already was implanted in her brain during that first year of growth? Because I've seen a difference between students that come over in their first 5 years from another country, they'll sound like an American, even though they may have been in a bilingual family. Because they know the culture and everything. Do you think your daughter, did she flip the switch? Does she sound like an American, or does she sound like an American that has another background?
No, she has sounded American from day one, I would say, because her first words were in English. But also every summer I sent her to Houston to stay with my mother over the summer. So she spent summers in hot Houston because school was out in Russia, and we didn't have grandparents sort of in Moscow with the dacha to send her to. And of course, my family in the US wanted time with the grandchild. So she spent summers growing up in Houston, and she also went to the British school and the Anglo-American school in Moscow.
Very nice. Okay. That was something I had never thought about with languages when people are multilingual. So interesting. Okay. I knew you were interesting from the first time I met you at one of the Orlando Women in Tech and Entrepreneurship, but let's keep going on this train. You made this switch from doing all of this overseas consultancy and you ended up in Canada. How did that happen?
So my American girlfriends in Moscow, I'd been divorced already 5 or 6 years in Russia. So I was a single mom in Moscow for a while. And my American girlfriends did this intervention on me one day and said, Michelle, you're not going to die in Russia. You're getting on eHarmony right now. We're forcing you to get a subscription for 6 months. And this was new. eHarmony was new. I don't even know what other dating apps there were. But long story short, I decided to play along with it. I didn't take it seriously at all. And I ended up my fourth date. My current husband, he flew to Toronto to have dinner with me. He flew to Boston to have dinner with me because I was in Boston at my dad's cottage. Or on the Cape, and he flew to Boston to have dinner with me, and we've been together ever since. So that was 2009. We dated long distance for a year, Moscow, Toronto, and then my daughter and I moved to Toronto, and that was the end of that.
So interesting. Okay, so now we're going to fast forward some more. Why the interest in nonprofit?
So living in Moscow for 15 years is like being on an island. And I didn't realize this until I fully left that country. When I landed in Canada, I learned really the first time about sustainability and climate change. And I really had a huge sense of guilt that I had served evil Russian oil for so long, because my main industry was serving the big oil companies, including being sort of the audit and risk or the risk management partner on the board of TNKBP, the British Petroleum Investment in Tyumenskaya Neftynaya Kompaniya, which is one of the largest Siberian oil companies. And I felt awful. I felt, what have I done? Okay, the good that I've done in Russia is, you know, created jobs for people and, you know, mentored a lot of really smart consultants. But in terms of the work, I felt sick. I literally felt sick. I thought, you know, how could I have spent that much time serving that industry and serving oligarchs and basically what we know now to be a lot of bad people. So in Canada, I said, I've got to switch. I've got to switch to social impact. I've got to switch to nonprofit. I've got to dedicate my energy to the social sector. And that's what led me to seek that out.
Okay. This just keeps getting better with every single one of these little blips in time in your life. Okay. So now we're over here and you started your own business and it's a nonprofit. Why did you choose to make that a nonprofit instead of for-profit?
So I didn't start the business until 2019. So I first worked right for, I don't know how many years, from 9 years in the, either in the social purpose sector or the nonprofit sector. So social purpose enterprise is a big thing in Canada. And I actually officed even out of the Center for Social Innovation, which got me introduced to that whole ecosystem in Toronto of the social entrepreneurs, and many of which are also nonprofits. But social entrepreneurship is actually a very common it was very common in Toronto, and I learned what that was, and worked for led a tech philanthropy company, doing philanthropy tech. And what made me start Mind Equity was really noticing how work had changed. So I got the idea. I was already starting to notice with the advent of the smartphone that our relationship with each other and our relationship with work was changing. And early on, I became intrigued with this idea of device-free experiences. And so early in 2019, my daughter was living in Armenia at the time. And Armenia is a place where you have panoramic views and is just a beautiful country. And so I got the idea to create an experience that I designed together with my daughter called Finding Awe in Armenia. So the idea was slow travel, device-free tourism. And I piloted this with 10 friends of mine, all who agreed to be device-free in advance of arriving. However, you can guess, this idea went out the window. As soon as they landed, they said, Michelle, I know we promised to be device-free, but we can't do this. We have to take pictures, even though we had my daughter organized as the videographer. And so getting over my annoyance with this, I really became the observer. So I became the observer of my companions for 10 days and started to write about it for myself, right? Started to write about what was the nuance of putting the device between the experience of this jaw-dropping view or the taking photos when having experiences with locals and having the photo be the central reason for being there rather than having the embodied experience of being there. So bringing this word embodiment back into the picture. And that led me to return to Canada after that trip and become an observer of the workplace. So I was working in a collaborative tech company. They were doing implementation of collaborative technology. And I was, again, doing the tech-driven change piece, the human side of the change. And I also began to observe and thought, we are really losing productivity here. We are losing our ability to communicate. And this is before COVID, right? We're losing our ability to interact meaningfully with other human beings because we always have our heads in a screen. And I began reading and researching and just nerding out on this topic of attention management and what is it and what's it doing to our prefrontal cortex, et cetera, et cetera. And so then COVID hit, work dried up, and I had no choice. Got to reinvent. So, because a lot of my work was also in-person facilitation. So that work dried up, of course. And in Canada, we were in COVID for 3 years. So I developed a new service line. And pretty much all I did was online training on how to focus better across the five elements that impact our ability to harness attention in teams, especially knowledge work teams, of course, where our brain is our value. And that's what led me to create Mind Equity. And I created it as a social purpose enterprise so that I would donate a portion of profits to organizations that were funding a good cause. And mostly my interest has always been in funding underprivileged children. And yeah, so that's where Mind Equity was started. But I am now in a pivot again. And I am pivoting to, instead of serving corporations, serving the consumer. So serving female professionals in midlife, high achieving female professionals in midlife who want more than just being powerful, successful, high achievers. A holistic approach to high productivity, high innovation, along with well-being. And I'm literally working with a branding person now to change the brand, change the service offering. So I don't know quite yet what it's going to become, but I was very much influenced because of the Women in Tech and Entrepreneurship group when I started that Orlando chapter when I got here from Canada, and listening to the stories and observing also the issues facing women in tech and the overwhelm and the multitasking and the challenges related to being a high-powered woman in tech, it just, yeah, had an impact on me as well. And thus I am in this pivot.
Yeah. The weather's so very, very different also when you came here. So I remember that was my first time from meeting you. And you talked about how different the weather was and you had to adjust to that. And then you were truly intrigued with everything about Rachel and the women in tech and entrepreneurship. And as I continued to go to those meetings, I was very impressed with your knowledge, with, you know, just not even just the knowledge, but your vernacular with how you would describe tech. And I went, oh, I've got to have her as a guest on my podcast. So it's been a pursuit. I know that we've talked about this a few times. So I'm thrilled that you're here. And, you know, just the wisdom that you have to share with the listeners, it's going to be very, very valuable. Once you decide what your organization, it's going to still stay the same name, correct?
Mind Actually, Equity? I'm being encouraged to create a personal brand with Michelle and Moore, Michelle Natalia Moore. So I don't know yet what might happen to Mind Equity. It might be because that brand name is also quite interesting and the meaning of the logo and all of that, but that's a bit tedious to get into, but it might just be the name of a program. But my branding strategist is encouraging me to go with michelleandmore.com. So that is a vulnerable place to be and a very interesting experiment and thought. And let's see, we'll decide in the next 30 days.
Well, based on what we've talked about so far, I am all for that because I think you have such interesting stories to be able to tell. As a keynote speaker, I'm sure that you'd be able to bring something that everybody in the room would be able to identify with. So I encourage that. I am voting with your consultant.
Thanks, Isabella.
Yeah.
Smart
I think
feedback.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I'm all for that. Okay. So when you got here, let's talk a little bit more about your wellness practice and nonprofit. What were you initially doing? It was during COVID. You came out of COVID and the focus was always on wellness at that place. But now that you're going in this other direction, what things are piquing your interest?
You know, I'll make a correction on that because I think my focus was always about how do we sustain high performance as knowledge workers, high effectiveness, not efficiency, but effectiveness, high performance, high effectiveness, and high ability to innovate without suffering or without burnout. And so my thought process around this was already maturing around attention management. So when I created Mind Equity, I was also very much following Humane Technology, who of course funded and helped create the documentary film, semi-documentary film called The Social Dilemma. And the Center for Humane Tech is also very much working, of course, on reducing the harms and helping advocate for legislation that will reduce the harms, the negative aspects of all the tech that is evolving so rapidly now. And because of the work and research that the Center for Humane Tech has done around attention, I, you know, agree with the hypothesis that attention is an asset as valuable as money. And it's our brain power, right? It's the body's mechanism for harnessing resources that we need for innovation and cognition and invention and creativity. And so Mind Equity was the Focus Better programs or Focus Better journeys, the online training that I was doing with teams was all around how do you design work in your teams to harness attention across all five elements that impact our ability to harness attention, being culture, of course, environment, the tool portfolio, the degree of balance we have, and our ability to focus. So that's what that idea was. And now going into the B2C space, that idea is still very present, especially with, you know, Cal Newport's new book on slow productivity coming out and David Sachs, the Canadian author, coming out, you know, with his book, The Future is Analog. So there are so many, and Maggie Jackson's book on distraction and Gloria Mark's book on attention span. So there's so much research now coming out. And of course, she had a large group at Microsoft that she was able to study and include in her research that was published in this book that really continues to support my gut feeling that attention management or attention asset management or attention capital management, if you want to create fancy words for this, is going to be a thing in the future. Not very many people are talking about it, but it's my favorite topic, right? So
I can tell. So Cal Newport, you said his book is Slow Productivity?
His brand new book is Slow Productivity. He, of course, also wrote the book Deep Work, and he wrote Digital Minimalism. And he just came out with Slow Productivity. And so many other authors are appearing out of the woodwork, writing on various aspects of this topic related to how do we protect the brain, the human brain, so that it can continue to utilize all this tech without eroding some of the brain power or well-being that is the result of overuse or over participation of our, you know, bodies and screens or heads and screens. And how can we? Yeah.
I have a question because I have noticed other people, because technology is moving so fast, and you may not have an answer for it, and that's okay, but this is just something I'm observing. Technology is moving so fast, and people, we used to memorize phone numbers. We used to have addresses and names and everything. And I've gone to so many events, and at first I was thinking it was me, but it's not. I've noticed a lot of people, different ages, men and women, going, oh, what is that called? And it seems like short-term memory is king. And it's because we only see pictures, we only skim, we're not reading. And so there's like a lack of deeper knowledge and a desire to actually read. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Isabella, I discovered my own memory loss during COVID. Yeah. So in the first year of COVID, I was a Zoom addict. And I also, I think my head was in a screen those first couple of months, maybe 8 hours a day. And I even lost use of my right shoulder because of repetitive mousing during those first 6 months of Zoom. So that was a wake-up call. So first there was a physical wake-up call that I couldn't lift my shoulder and needed to do a lot of physical therapy in order to get it back and get off of mouse clicking. I just trained my left hand to mouse click now, and I can't do it as much. But again, because I was in this topic, I was like, oh my gosh, what a hypocrite am I, that I already have been studying attention management or taking a break from your screens. And here I am in COVID, having memory loss, cognitive overload, and losing use of my right arm because of repetitive mouse clicking. And that, again, is this wake-up call to, you know, I thought, oh, I'm an aware person on this. But no, I got sucked in. I got sucked in because there was nothing else to do. You know, I was launching, you know, I was doing talks online at all these online conferences, and I was getting energy from that. And it turned out, I think since then I've had memory issues, to be honest. So I have to take a lot of notes. I make it a practice to really physically write in a notebook. And I have to review my notes, and also in networking events, you know, nobody has name tags. I wish we had name tags, but I can't remember people's names. I have to write down who I met and make a little note of some detail that I find interesting in order to remember the name next time. And I think it's not just me.
No, it's not. And one of the things that I've seen a lot of people say that they have short podcasts. And I went, no, I really like being able to spend an hour of having a conversation and listening to a person, because it creates like something that we don't normally do anymore, it seems. You know, we go to events, we're in and out. We have 3-minute conversations in and out. Like what are we establishing here? There's no real relationships of substance. There's no memory that's being, you know, a part of the woven story that we're having with these people. So I'm a big advocate of whatever it is you're doing too. I'm going to go, yes, let's get back to basics, because I absolutely 100% believe we're going to have to teach people how to have relationships outside of anything that's digital and video. We're going to have to be able to teach people, just like we used to have etiquette, we still need it, but how to have conversations when you go to networking, how to just not hide behind the screens and really remember people to be relational.
Well, I really respect how you're doing the long form podcast, because it enables us to have a generative dialogue rather than a transactional dialogue. Yes. So we're generating new information just by virtue of taking the time to speak to each other in a more meaningful or in-depth way. And, you know, part of this training I did at the Presencing Institute on awareness-based systems change talks about the 4 levels of listening. And the first level being just going, and agreeing with everybody. The second level, kind of disagreeing, but not moving on. The third level, having empathy. And the fourth level, generative dialogue, where something new is created out of the dialogue that wasn't there before. And that is something hard to create or to allow to arise, right? How do we create conditions for generative dialogue to arise? And I think you do that on your podcast. I listened to like 5 different episodes before coming here. And I just wanted to listen to more, because each of them, they're so interesting because it's generative dialogue, and that's rare. Mm-hmm. So woohoo, Isabella.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate it. So I took some notes. I am taking notes during our call here, because that's how I create my show notes. And I always tell that to people so they know what's coming. We're going to be jumping into your favorite quote and why. Now, I know you gave me 3, but you're going to get to pick one. So it can be Mary Oliver. You had 2 from Mary Oliver, or Arwana Ayasha.
Arwana Hayashi.
Arwana Hayashi. Yes, thank you.
Arwana Hayashi is a remarkable woman who is at the Presencing Institute and with whom I took my embodiment training. So embodied facilitation. So helping teams tap into the collective wisdom of the team to better innovate and create, and also to have more meaningful dialogue to solve difficult problems by tapping into the wisdom of the collective team rather than just using data analysis. And so she has several quotes, but the funniest one is, and the one that I remember most often and use most often, is that our body is not just a transportation unit for the head.
Love it. So true.
Our body has wisdom in it.
Yeah.
And if we could listen to it more, Yeah, I think we'd be better off.
Yeah, I'm going to go and look for this woman. I'm going to look for Cal's book on the one that I just mentioned, Slow Productivity.
Slow Productivity.
And then also this woman, Arwana, her book, The Art of a True Move. I don't know if that's where the quote came from, but I'm going, now I have two books that I'm going to have to go and get.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take a moment and acknowledge our sponsor, Cat 5 Studios, and we will be right back.
The Intern Whisperer is brought to you by Cat 5 Studios, who help you create games and videos for your training and marketing needs that are out of this world. Visit Cat 5 Studios for more information to learn how Cat 5 Studios can help your business. Thank you, Cat 5 Studios.
Now, I know, listeners, we did not finish the first half of the show, so I'm going to ask Michelle one more question that I always ask at the end. What would you want to be remembered for in your life?
How much I helped people.
I can see that. I can definitely see that.
Because I can tell you now, too, that with the two wars that I'm observing, the war in Ukraine and the war in Israel and Palestine, and I know so many people connected to both of these wars, Russians, Ukrainians, Israelis, and Palestinians, that the tragedy of women and children in this situation is unspeakable. And, you know, my husband and I created a private charitable foundation in Canada called the Inspire Children and Youth Foundation. And we're just in the process of creating the strategy for that. And we're looking closely at which pockets of society can we fund, which organizations can we fund that are really doing a great job of helping in these situations and helping in particular women and children, the most vulnerable, so that they can become inspired members of society. And I think we have the privilege, we're blessed with the privilege of being able to do something through a foundation and personally as humans through the work that we're doing, that I think that is a on the side of, you know, rebranding my business. I think even more important is what do we do with this brand new foundation that we created, and who do we help? And how does that have positive impact in the world?
Yeah, you've had a huge impact by, you know, helping some 10 Ukrainian families be able to, I imagine, migrate over to the United States.
Canada.
And then the Syrian refugee family also. Like, this is significant work that's being done.
It's really on the backbone of Canadian immigration policy, I would say, because both of these initiatives, these grassroots initiatives, happened in Canada. And when the Syrian crisis was happening, I was again remembering my mother's war stories, which she had, even though she was, you know, age 3 to 8 in this, in the transition of, you know, well, first of all, fleeing the new East Germany and moving to the West and being a refugee. These stories are just heart-wrenching. And when the Syrian war was happening, Canada opened up its doors to create a program that allowed grassroots mobilization. You could get 10 people together to raise $30,000 to sponsor a family for a year. And so I did that through a woman's collective. I was part of a woman's club, executive club in Toronto called Verity. And within a week, we had enough people to donate the funds. And then we were able to fund this family for a year coming, a family of three. And then the Ukrainian story is more personal. Also, again, why Canada? Because Canada opened the doors for easy travel visas, including work permits for fleeing Ukrainians when the war started, when the war with Russia started. And so because on the backbone, again, then of this Canadian immigration program, one of my best friends in Toronto is Ukrainian. So she was bombarded with requests from people she'd grown up with, people she'd gone to high school with. And I just joined her team and got assigned to, you know, 10 people. And over the course of that first 6-7 month period, and it was just a naturally arising situation. And I've also helped one Russian person leave, an activist, a close friend of mine. And because the Russian story is also tragic of the people that.
So what do you think 2030 is going to look like, given that you have definitely a global outlook on the world? And you've seen what work is like and what technologies, you know, these places have in the world. What do you think 2030, which is, we don't count this year, we don't count 2030, it's basically 5 years difference. The world might look like, the jobs, the industries, what do you think?
So because I'm an optimist, I'm going to give an optimistic viewpoint.
That's good. We need that right now.
Yeah, and my optimism is weakened a bit, I think, but I'm going to remain an optimist. So my optimism tells me that on the whole, we as humans are going to be smart enough to figure out how to put in the right guardrails so that we can continue to harness tech for good and problem solving and everything wonderful that we need it to do, but that we can put the guardrails in place so that evil doesn't take over. I just have to have faith that as humans in every country, that we are going to be smart enough to do that.
Yep.
And there is hope, because we have no other choice. On the front of war, I don't know what to say, but I still have to say that, you know, we've always been a world at war. And the resulting impact, while tragic, eventually it has always ended. Mm-hmm. And so my hope is that the learnings can just be passed on to other generations so that we don't have the degree of human suffering that we do now. But climate change is another matter, right? So we have to figure out how to stop the flooding and stop the fires. But I do think the future of work is going to change on an annual basis, if not faster. And I'm going to argue with the author David Sacks, who wrote The Revenge of the Analog and his last book, The Future is Analog, that there are going to be new jobs created for in-person device-free experiences, for the in-person embodied experience, for maybe more learning of music or more sport or more horse riding or more being in nature, and facilitating that at a group and community level so that it's not so difficult. Because on our own, tearing ourselves away from devices and getting enough of a break to where we can stay healthy physically as well as mentally, it's very hard to do this alone because there's so much pull. It's designed to pull us away, as we all know. So I do predict that there is going to be more in-person experience in all industries, in all facets of how we have in-person experiences, be it from the professional to the community to the personal, because I don't see how our brains can stay healthy if we don't have that.
I find that one sentence, everything you said was spot on. I would agree with you totally. Technology is designed to pull us away. And I went, you know, that's an interesting take on what it is, because there's always powers that we don't know and that we don't see that are behind some of the things that we're doing. We all, I think that most people are aware that TikTok, the ads that we look at, having them in a real format versus, you know, a landscape format, all of these things create something in the brain that makes us want it, kind of like a drug addict, if you will.
Well, dopamine hit. It's just the dopamine hit. It's the attention economy, right? I do think that our business models need to change, especially for the social media companies. The business model is what's driving the dopamine hits, because that's what they need to make money. But another profession that I think is going to increase is in the legal profession, on how to put the guardrails on, you know, hate speech and misogyny. And, you know, a new book came out, I don't remember the name of it, but a journalist wrote about the increase of misogyny on TikTok and Snapchat. That is just horrendous. And unfortunately, again, women and girls suffer the most. But I think the legal profession is going to need deep skills in putting the guardrails, not just in court cases, but on the companies, such that the business models are not incentivizing this kind of damage.
Well, you have hit one of the next questions is what impact positively or negatively can AI, you know, this is our trends now, it's here, it's not going away. So what is it that we should be focused on? And there's the negative impact of, like you said, dopamine and how it does create a false sense of desire and hunger and pleasure, which is not accurate. But how can we put more guardrails, as you will, around it? I know that was a concern of Jeffrey Hinton. He's the godfather of AI. He was interviewed on 60 Minutes back in October of last year. And that was his concern, guardrails. We're going to need to do it. Personally, I'm looking for ethics groups that are out there on AI. You know, I'm going, how can I join one? How could I be something that I feel that I can make a difference in the world for that?
Yeah, again, the Center, AI for Good and the Center for Humane Tech, and there are many others, of course. But I do think that we're going to revolutionize healthcare. I think what's exciting is the healthcare innovations that are coming with AI. That's fantastic for everyone. So again, I want to focus on the positive and on the ability for global learning. I mean, you have disadvantaged communities able to get degrees online now. I mean, there's so much in education too that is excellent. Mm-hmm. Lack of in-person learning is a problem for sure. But you know, when you look at underprivileged communities on this planet, they are getting access to information and to education more than they ever have before, provided they can get a device. And the devices are getting cheaper and cheaper. And you know, you can do a degree through a mobile phone practically now, I think. And I think this is amazing and should continue. But on the topic of guardrails, there are so many facets of that that I just hope the funding is there and the will is there to change the business models. Because if you change the business model and the financial incentive, I think that is the key. And I'm not anti-capitalist at all. I'm for free enterprise 100%. But I think the business models, and this is what is argued by the Center for Humane Technology, is that the business models are what's driving the addictive tech behavior, because that is how the design is built in.
Yeah, it is. It is. Because when you have investors that say, okay, I'll invest in this, and if you have out-of-country investors that say, yes, I want to invest in this, the companies are trying to make their investors happy. So we lose sight as to what the perhaps the original mission statement was of an organization. And we're being driven by money.
But right now, probably it's equal. You know, the good and the bad is kind of, you know, tied in the race at this point. Yeah. And if we can, so it's still super exciting. And yeah. I use ChatGPT myself for productivity, and I don't find it excellent, but I find it great. And mm-hmm. I will continue to explore tools. But
I don't think chat is anything to be fearful. It's like fearful of, because it is just the same as when we would do a Google search. We would find all of the resources, we would put it together, and it would be exactly whatever we wanted it to be, that message, that report, that study. It just does it. It takes all of that collaborative information that's out in the world, good and the bad, and it's on us to make sure, oh, is this peer reviewed? Oh, what's this really?
Yeah, we can discern. We have the control over the discernment on it. So yeah. This is, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that's the advantage of it. Faster research, faster preparation of a draft that can yield something more quickly in the world. How can our listeners, what is the best mentoring advice that you have for our listeners?
Well, I think I shared with you in the pre-conversation that learn to listen to your gut.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much data, so much analysis that we can tap into, and we're taught to rely on research and analysis and data, which we absolutely need. Never discard it. Never discard the facts, but also listen to your gut. Listen to your gut, your instinct, your sense, your higher knowing, because both pieces of data are invaluable in making key decisions. And do your research, but don't ignore those gut feelings.
I agree with you 100%. Many times, like, I'll take it on the most minute ability, is I practice Duolingo every day. And I sit here, I go, oh, I think that's the answer. And then I see another one, I go, oh, no, that's the answer. And if I had gone with the first one, I would have had it right. And that's just a smallest example of where a decision is just to go in a completely different direction. But when it comes to ethics, we know the difference between right and wrong. We have to pay attention to those things. If that little warning is going out there, like what I was mentioning to you earlier, it's like people really don't have long-term memory. They don't try anymore. It's like we need to wake up.
Amen.
Yeah. Amen to that too. Well, Michelle, I know our listeners, we give your website and your LinkedIn profile. Is there any other way you would like our listeners to reach out to you?
Just those two are great.
They are perfect. I agree. Okay. So it's, you want to tell us the website for you?
Yes, it is Mind Equity, MIND, and the word equity, EQUITY.org.
And
on LinkedIn, I think it's Michelle N. Moore.
It is Michelle. Yeah. Two L's in Michelle also, just so people know.
Two L's in Michelle.
Yeah. Anyway, it's been delightful having you here. Thank you so much. You did not disappoint. I'm so grateful.
Lovely. I enjoyed it immensely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you to our sponsor, Cat5 Studios. Our video editor is Max Stein. Our music is by Sophie Lloyd. Visit www.e4c.tech to learn how you can recruit, assess, and improve employee learning and your company culture through DEI skills, hiring, and learning. Become an E4C member today. Mention you listen to the show and you may get the chance to become a guest on the Intern Whisperer podcast. You can support the Intern Whisperer by sharing, commenting, liking, and subscribing on YouTube or your favorite podcast streaming apps.